American Prairie is a local nonprofit working to connect and conserve more than 3 million acres of prairie grassland in Montana's northern Great Plains. American Prairie is one of the most ambitious conservation projects in existence today, representing an unprecedented opportunity to preserve temperate grasslands, which are one of the most threatened ecosystems in the world. To learn more about the incredible work American Prairie is doing for birds, habitat, wildlife, and local communities, visit www.americanprairie.org.
This episode of the American Birding Podcast is brought to you by HX Expeditions, offering mindful adventures to curious travelers since 1896. An HX Expedition cruise is the best way to see some of the world's rarest birds, like McKay's bunting. With onboard science centers, ornithologists, photographers, and a range of outdoor activities, an HX Expedition is a birder's paradise. Change the way you see the world. Book now and find out why birders are raving about HX. Hello and welcome to the American Birding Podcast from the American Birding Association. I'm your host, Nate Swick, back, at least for the time being. Thanks to my ABA colleagues for helping me out the last couple weeks. I can't say I'm back permanently just yet, so you'll hear from others again in the future. But for now, you've got me. What to talk about? Well, I wish I could say I've been doing a lot of birding lately, but the truth is I haven't. But even though my active bins out eBird-oriented outings are fewer, it's hard not to notice the comings and goings of birds in my neighborhood, or at my kids' soccer games, or anywhere I happen to be. The northern mockingbird on my neighbor's house with its truly impressive suburban repertoire as I take out the garbage bins to the curb in the morning. The dark-eyed junco picking its way through the catkins and the Bradford pear behind my house. The last one I'll probably see this spring. Truly a bit of joy amongst those god-awful invasive pests of a plant. Not on my property, otherwise they'd be gone. Screaming, red-shouldered hawks circling down the street trying to coast their brand new babies into the air with a tasty snake dangling from their talons. There's a solace, I think, in knowing that these birds are living their lives alongside my own, whether or not I'm inclined to pay attention to them or not. Little touch points when other things are on your mind, little indulgences you can drop into as much or as little as you want to, as you need to. Always there, available to take you away for a moment, always waiting for when it can give it more time. Sooner, take it or leave it. I've invited friends George Armistead and Amy Davis to come ready to discuss the spiciest birding takes that we can find. And we got some, and they deliver. All that after this week's Rare Birds. This is your Rare Bird Alert for the middle of April 2024. Spring means all the normal birds are heading northward once again, but it also usually means that some weird ones find their way along with them. After a relatively slow March, rare bird season returns with a vengeance to the ABA area, starting in South Texas, where else, where that state's first record of southern lapwing was seen this week in Hidalgo County. You might remember the southern lapwing saga in 2022 when an individual turned up in Michigan, where it hung out at a cargo and service airport in Huron County for several months. That bird was determined to be a wild vagrant and subsequently accepted by the Michigan Bird Records Committee and the ABA Checklist Committee as an ABA area first record, and the first of what we imagined would be additional records of this species, whose range has expanded dramatically into Central America in recent years. That trend looks to be continuing with this current Texas bird at a location that is likely to raise far fewer eyebrows than the Michigan bird. This week, Florida hosted not one but two different piratic flycatchers, one in Pinellas County on the Central Gulf Coast and a second the next day in Key West. Since the ABA area's first record of this widespread neotropic flycatcher in 1991, also from Florida, interestingly enough, it has occurred in the United States just shy of a dozen times, mostly in Florida, where these two new birds represent the state's third and fourth records, and Texas, but also New Mexico and Kansas. And last, normally a common shelduck in France would not be noteworthy, but on the tiny French overseas territory territory of Saint-Pierre-et-Miquelon, it's another matter entirely. A bird seen there is the territory's first, but at least two common shell ducks have been seen in nearby Newfoundland in recent weeks, part of the impressive movement of European vagrants as a result of strong transatlantic winds experienced on the island that continues this week with another whooper swan and a small flock of black-tailed godwits to add to the already impressive assemblage of Eurasian species there. That is all we have this week, but for the full list, check out the ABA Rare Bird Alert on Fridays at aba.org/RBA. You can also follow along with all the rare bird news in our ABA Rare Bird Alert group on Facebook and on ABA Community. All right, so we've got a new segment for the American Birding Podcast that I am calling Take It or Leave It. The idea being that birders have lots of hot takes, some serious, some silly, about how bird watching is supposed to be done. And we're going to work through a few of them here today. But before we explain a little bit more about how this will work and how I got my collection of takes, I want to introduce our panel for this episode. Both have been guests on the American Birding Podcast before, and both have strong and thoughtful opinions about birding. I'm excited to tell them how they're wrong. Welcome to Amy Davis, Associate Editor of the ABA's North American Birds Journal. Hi, Amy. Welcome back.
Hey, Nate. Thanks for having me.
Great to see you. And next, he's one of the hosts of the excellent Lifeless podcast. If you don't get enough of your birding podcast hit from this one, please check that one out. And a new ABA board member. Yeah, it's our old friend, George Armistead. Hello, George.
Hey, Nate. Hey, Amy. Very happy to be here. Excited to chat.
Quite a little bit of a Philadelphia feel for this opinion. Please don't.
Yeah, Jersey Philly in the house.
Yeah. good to see you. Here's what I have. I have asked the internet for their spiciest birding hot takes, and the internet, as it does, provided. I have a number of opinions here to discuss. I will share them one at a time, and then we will all decide individually whether we take it, meaning that we agree with this opinion, or leave it. Obviously disagree. Are we ready?
I think so. Yeah.
All right. I'm going to start with your Lifeless co-host, Alvaro Jaramillo, who has also been on the podcast before. He has a lot of great birding opinions, and we're going to jump into one of his. Most birders do not have a spark bird, but they make one up because they think they need to have one. What do you think? Are you taking it or are you leaving it?
I think I'm going to leave it.
All right.
Like, I think that there is a segment of the birding population for whom this is true. Mm-hmm. But I just feel like I hear about too many epiphany spark bird moments. I also think there's a lot of us that have multiple spark birds, right? Yeah. Sometimes it's not sort of one big moment, but kind of a steady drip. And then there's like a breakthrough kind of. But I don't know. I think spark birds are a real thing. And okay. I think Alvaro, as often the case, is being a contrarian.
He's being a disturber of the cacao. What do you got, Amy?
I'm with George. Leave it. Leave this one. I absolutely have a spark bird. Wow. I have a bird that made me run to the bookstore and grab the first best looking bird book off the shelf, which was Ken Kaufman's Lives of North American Birds. Mm-hmm. And it's a great blue heron.
Okay. All right.
And here I am 20 years later. Yeah.
20 years later, still doing it, still looking at herons. I'm going to take it just because I like
bold,
this opinion.
Bold, Nate.
So this is where we slice and dice the specific words that Alvaro uses here, where he says most birders do not have a spark bird. Maybe I jumped too much to take it, but I think most birders probably do have a spark bird. But I do agree with you, George, that there is a number of people who maybe don't. And for me, for instance, it was that sort of steady drip, 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 drip of new birds and getting engaged in birding. Does this opinion change at all if you ask, do you have a favorite bird? Does that change the way you approach this this take at all?
I mean, I have a spark bird, but probably not a favorite bird.
Oh, yeah.
My favorite bird
is going to change every week.
Well, that's exactly. Yeah. And then people always ask you, what's your favorite bird when they find out you're a birder? And
I'm wearing one of mine today.
Yeah, yeah, blue jay. Nice. Very nice.
Well, here we go.
There you go.
Beauteous.
I don't have any birds on mine. I should have worn a bird shirt.
Oh, no.
I have a Tar Heel shirt on.
Yeah, but everyone asks the favorite bird as if you're supposed to have a favorite bird, but I don't have one. I've come to one that I usually give just because I'd like to avoid the question. It's sort of causes an existential crisis.
You mean the favorite bird?
Yeah, the favorite bird question. I have like 3 or 4 spark birds, though. Or birds that could be considered spark birds.
I'm curious what you give as your favorite bird.
Yellow-breasted chat.
Always. That's a good one. That's a good choice. Yeah.
Just because there was one point down the road where I was like, I need to come up with like a justification for a favorite bird so that it's not like...
Good Carolina bird.
Yeah, well, it's that. It's also the logo on the Carolina Bird Club has a chat logo, and that's the name of our quarterly journal. I had to think of like a good criteria for what would be a favorite bird, and it basically came to a bird that I see often enough, but that always makes me happy when I see it. When I always see him, like, oh yeah, yellow-breasted chat. I always get stoked when I see one because I don't see it all the time, but I do see it often enough that I get to enjoy it. So that makes a favorite bird for me.
Was that pre it being elevated to its own family?
That was pre. Wow. But that makes it better. The icing really does. On the cake. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. What was your spark bird, George? Just out of curiosity.
Yeah, I have several.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, like brown creeper, pileated woodpecker, blue-winged teal.
Yeah.
Those were like, each of those was like a moment that I remember and that eventually just like, you know, snowballed out of control.
Do each of your spark birds sort of represent a different aspect of birding to you? Because that's sort of the way it has been for me. Because I could see like brown creeper being the bird that very common, but you always miss it until one point you don't miss it anymore. Like you find them all the time.
Pileated woodpecker, I remember running to my dad and being like, Dad, I saw Woody Woodpecker. Yes. Woody Woodpecker, Dad.
Absolutely.
So it fulfilled the cartoon role for me.
Yeah, very good. All right, we'll move on to the next one. Here's a hot take from David Scott. Big day records are more impressive and more reflective of real birding skill than big year records. Take it or leave it.
I gotta leave it. I gotta leave it.
Okay.
Because you have to sustain that drive over a whole year for a big year. Whereas one day it's amazing. It's probably very tough. That's why I haven't done it. But it's hard to keep the momentum going for a whole year, especially when you're kind of in the doldrums of
absolutely.
I don't know.
Absolutely.
March.
Whether that counts as birding skill, I'm not sure, but it's definitely like a mental aspect that is sort of underappreciated when you're talking about big years, I think. Yeah. How about you, George? Take it or leave it?
Yeah, you know, I think I'm going to take it.
Okay.
Maybe I'm showing my bias here in that I've never really attempted a big year, but I've done, you know, a lot of big days over the years, and I like big days better. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's a bias, but I do think and it's sort of alluding to what Amy said, it's like a big year is almost like a war of attrition. It's like you have to be able to just, you know, day after day, get after it, you know, it's big hard. Day. It's like a burst you have, you know, and you really have to be so careful with your time. There's all the planning and then there's all the field skills, right? There's mm-hmm. all like the, you know, picking stuff up by ear, yeah, like it's so much about ear birding. I feel like there's a lot of skill involved there. So I'm going to take David Scott's hot take there. I like it.
Yeah, I kind of went back and forth on this because I was thinking like to what extent does preparation kind of play a role in big day records? Because big day, like a real serious big day attempt, like World Series of Birding, for instance, there's like a week, several days of preparation that goes into kind of finding these birds and nailing them down. Yes, there is some birding skill involved in that, but to some extent, the big day itself is going, stopping at a spot, ticking it, moving on. And there are different skills involved in both of them, but I'm not sure that there's enough in the big day to make it like more reflective of real birding skill. Because I think they both have kind of quirky aspects to them that minimize the actual skill needed in the actual event, if that makes any sense. Because I know big year, people who used to do big years, you know, there was that famous big year back in the 80s, I think, where the guy just basically got a guide to lead him everywhere and he broke the then record. and you know how much birding skill is engaged with that. But I think modern big year records like John Weigel's involved a ton of skill, not only you know knowing where birds are and what birds are, but finding them when they actually get there. That's an important skill as well. So I think I'm going to leave it, but very tentatively. Like I'm not exactly sure how I feel. I could go back on this. Like
you could waffle
tomorrow. I could waffle. Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, you know, averse to conflict here. I'm going to waffle on that one. But I guess if you pin me to the wall, I'm going to say I'm going to leave it.
I was going to say we got to choose, right?
Isn't yeah, that you have to. That's the nature of the exercise here.
Yeah.
All right, here's another one. This one comes from Liam Taylor. I got this one on Blue Sky. In all correspondence about birds, including emails, listservs, all species common names should be capitalized. Yellow warbler, yellow, capital Y, capital W, not lowercase or all uppercase, which is a little intimidating. So what do you feel about capitalization of bird names in media, any media at all?
Oh, I am a serial all caps user. Always have been. You know why? Because sometimes you want to scan the whole email post. If I'm including details or whatever, you want to see the bird name because you might not read all of it.
That's a good point. That does add a little wrinkle into this take for sure.
Yeah, it's just for readability. I don't know.
Yeah, I think if it's like a rare bird, I have no problem with all caps. Mm. Like, and I think for like general writing about birds, like in a book or if you're like writing real prose, then I capitalize. I think like,
Of course.
Yeah. I find just, you know, yellow warbler, capital Y, capital W. I find it so frustrating.
I was just going to say, as someone that has written several bird books, like, does it annoy you when you see lowercase y, lowercase w?
It really annoys me. I have a strong distaste for that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. No, I'm the same way. Yeah.
Yeah. Only immoral humans would not capitalize. Yeah.
Send it out there to all those editors who are editing books that are about birds. I don't know if you've seen this. It used to be that if it was a field guide, it's always capital. But if it was like a general book about birds that was put out by kind of a legacy publishing house, like they would always be lowercase, or in a lot of media, if they write about birds. And so you see in a lot of that. But these days, I think the authors of those sorts of books are a little more
flexible.
Yeah. And so I like, for instance, like Jennifer Ackerman's stuff, like she does capital, thank mm-hmm. God. And there's a lot of books of that ilk that are starting to do the capital when I think 10 years ago they wouldn't have.
Yeah. And like you say, I think sort of stuff that's meant for the more general public, mm-hmm. I think often would not use the uppercase. And in those cases, I'd be like, I couldn't help it. I'd be like, they're not really writing for me, you know?
Oh, man. It's like, yeah, there's a hot take.
Like, that's how I felt. I was like, I don't know. Like, this, they're not speaking the language.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So do we take it or leave it? Ultimately, all correspondence about birds, take it.
All correspondence, though?
Oh, that's the key. Oh, all right. Yeah. I'll take it.
But I'm going to keep my caps.
I understand the caps. This gets to the question about, banding codes, too, like use of banding codes in those. This one is not one that came up, but do you take that or do you leave it? Is there an appropriate time and place for banding codes or do you avoid them?
I love banding codes for like eBird and all that stuff, but mm-hmm. I feel like it's a little bit gatekeepy to use them when you're putting out like a mass text or an email or something.
Yeah,
unless you name, write out the full name first and then mm-hmm. just for then refer to the banding code. But.
Except for Sora, it shouldn't be allowed.
Sora is the exception that proves the rule always. All right, here's another good one. This is another one from Cassie Ferry. People who like sea watching are faking it. Take it or leave it.
Oh, man. And Cassie comes up with some really good stuff, I got to say.
One.
Yeah. And I'm leaving this. I'm leaving this so exactly where
it is. Does this hurt you?
I left it an hour ago.
Yeah,
it's like 50 miles behind me already.
Yeah, yeah. It's a good hot take, but I am going to leave it right where it is.
Hot.
Yeah.
I'm going to play devil's advocate here. I'm going to take it.
He's inland. He's inland, Amy. He doesn't understand.
I have spent a lot
of time.
Maybe
he gets really seasick.
It could be.
On the beach. Yeah, I get seasick on the beach. I have spent a lot of time sea watching, and I have had a handful of exciting moments, but 90% of it is drudgery, I'll tell you. And people tend to really, really emphasize those exciting moments, which, to be fair, can be really good. You see a Jaeger fly by, or you see something particularly, a whale. That's always fun. But for the most part, man, it's a lot of work for what feels like not a ton of reward.
Neat. Get better pelagic friends.
Yeah, really.
You're with the wrong crew.
I love pelagics. I love going out on the boat to go out to see the birds. It's sitting on the shore with a scope, looking at those tiny dots on the horizon and trying really hard to figure out what those are. That can be a little bit frustrating. And because you feel like there's good stuff like just over there, but sometimes because of the heat haze or because of the waves or because of whatever, it can be very difficult to get an identification on this. Maybe I just need to get better. I just need to get good at the skill issue, as the kids on the internet say.
I think a little bit of weather makes
weather makes a big difference.
Big
yeah, difference. You get a nice wind blowing in. That does make it more fun than any other kind of wind, for sure. All right. I've got a couple of records committee takes here that I think are going to elicit some discussion here. That a lot of people have opinions about records committees, as you do. The bird police are out there deciding whether you saw the bird or not, obviously. And so we've got some takes on records committees. And I say this as a current member of a record committee. I don't know if y'all are currently on a records committee.
We both have been. I don't know if we currently are.
Yeah.
I'm not.
Current member of two of them.
I'm a current, terrible member of a record committee when I was a chair last year, and I'm still trying to write up the yearly report. Anyway, we're going to start with one from Aiden Place.
Good Pennsylvania birder.
There you go. Records committees no longer serve much of a purpose, or at least not in anything resembling their current form. And their failure to adapt to the eBird area. This is actually two takes, and we can take them separately if you want. Their failure to adapt to the eBird area is largely due to an overinflated sense of their own value. Sounds like Aiden has had issues with the bird records committees nearby. I don't know whether I take the second one, but I do think the first take is worth discussing. Are records committees, do they still serve a purpose in this age of eBird reviewers?
So I feel like Aiden may be underestimating the amount of overlap there is between eBird reviewers and
there is a lot of overlap.
Committees. I was an eBird reviewer 10 or 15 years ago.
As was I.
And I know we've got several on the committees that I'm on. So, I mean, it's really not two separate groups of people, first of all.
When it is, and maybe this is to approach his second position, there is less conflict with eBird than there used to be. I remember when eBird was sort of taking a 10 years ago when eBird was growing, and a lot of people were putting their bird records in eBird instead of submitting to committees like they had for decades in the past. There was some conflict, but it does feel like most bird records committees have adopted eBird as another avenue for learning about birds and getting these reports that they need to vote on.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Or, the question, I guess, does that voting matter?
Well, first of all, I think the purpose of the records committees is not it's really to maintain a good, solid list of all the birds that have been seen in the state.
So
that involves not only voting on current records, but researching in the literature to find stuff from 100 years ago or more to keep that really complete list. That's not something that you're necessarily going to find in eBird. And if it is an eBird, it's probably because a volunteer from the records committee went in and carefully entered all those historical records.
Hello, I am that volunteer.
And the other thing that we do, at least on the New Jersey records committee, is we put out an annual report. And Nate, it sounds like you guys do too, to kind of put all of the accepted records into context, which is something you're not going to get so much of from eBird. And I do, I love eBird and I've been using it since 2003. So
yeah, I think Amy's point is a really good one, which is exactly what I thought of, which is that the main purpose, and I should say also that this is a good hot take. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna leave it. But I'm like, it's not a super strong leave it for me. But I do think that Amy's point that looking at Pennsylvania, for example, the PORC, an unfortunate acronym for a great organization.
Thank you for not using that. When did that start happening? I feel like it was not a thing.
Yeah, it's there. I think there's some worse ones out there, perhaps. But at any rate, it is a bunch of great folks doing hard work. And as like eBird reviewers, it is pretty much thankless work. If you do everything right, and you know, basically nobody says anything. And if you do anything that's seen as wrong, you're crucified. For all of eternity, but like, here's what it says. We are a group of volunteers tasked with maintaining the official list of the birds of Pennsylvania. So that's their primary goal. That is a different goal than eBird's goal. And now they have expedited review for, I think, pretty much every state records committee at this point has what they call expedited review, right? Which basically means if eBird reviewers have accepted it and it looks solid and none of the records committee objects to it, then they pretty much, it just sails on through. I forget the exact process.
That pretty much covers it, at least for PORC.
Okay. Yeah. So I think, you know, I understand from a review standpoint, almost all birders are going to feel and see the impact of eBird review. They're not really going to see or feel the impact of a records committee view. But let's say that the State Game Commission wants an official list of the birds of Pennsylvania. They're probably going to go to the Pennsylvania Society for Ornithology. They may or may not go to eBird. But mm-hmm. I think it does serve a role. I think it's up to these committees to determine that role is relevant and well maintained moving ahead. However.
Yeah, this is probably more a fact, the way that the birding has changed in the last decade or so. And, you know, everyone is carrying cameras now. So many of the good, so quote unquote, good birds that are recorded in a lot of these states are well, well documented. And so this gets to another take that we can talk about here in a bit. You know, it is weird sometimes to be on a rarity committee and you have, you know, 15, 20 records coming in a packet to vote on, and every single one of them is well documented with multiple photos, many of which are collated on eBird. And so they just have put the link to the Macaulay Library of the photos of this bird, and you're like, why am I, what difference does it make if I vote yes on this record when it's an eBird? But every once in a while you get one of those records that doesn't have that stuff, and you do kind of notice the importance. And I think a lot of the changes in what the records committees are having to, you know, think about and discuss these days has a lot to do with, you know, invasive species, exotic species, populations of those birds in our states, and kind of, you know, documenting that, which is interesting, I guess, because here where I live in North Carolina, Egyptian goose is starting to show up, and Muscovy duck has been kind of showing up a little bit. And if they ever get around to splitting mottled duck in the Gulf Coast and Florida populations, that's going to be a giant headache for the Carolinas, because most of the mottled ducks in our state were introduced for hunting purposes many years ago and are from the Western Gulf Coast population and not the Florida population. So we've got to, you know, that sort of stuff can still only really be done by records committees. So I will leave this tentatively, but I understand where it is coming from.
Isn't also, Nate, that very, I don't remember, but it used to be that the ABA Checklist Committee, when dealing with, say, a new record for North America, they often would look and see how a state records committee dealt with that record initially to see what all the information was and, you know, to kind of give them a leg up. And I don't know if that is still the case or is still necessary or part of the protocol.
Yeah.
But at the very least, I would think, like, thinking about the black-backed oriole that we had here in Pennsylvania remains controversial. I remain very pro wild bird still. There were a couple previous reports elsewhere in the U.S., but I believe that the ABA Checklist Committee ended up looking. There was a lot of material that went around for that particular record. I'm sure there's other records similar sprinkled around that the ABA Checklist Committee would have benefited from the committee work done on those particular records.
Yeah, I know for a fact, speaking about my state, the Zenos Petrel, every once in a while we get like weird seabirds that show up in North Carolina because, as you know, George and Amy, very popular pelagic destination. And every once in a while we get weird stuff. And,
good place for sea watching.
I'm told. but every once in a while we get those. And I know Zenos Petrel, there was some conflict there. But eventually was accepted by the ABA checklist. And yeah, they usually do wait for the state to act. But in some cases, when the state doesn't act, which may happen with, differing opinions about ship assistance and whatnot, in the future that may happen. But I don't have any sort of insider information for people on the checklist.
It just seems in an increasingly chaotic world.
Yeah, it seems like that's going to happen.
Yeah,
for sure. So I guess, what was our opinion on that? Leave it? Was it three leave it's?
Yeah.
Three leave it's. We're leaving it. Sorry, Aiden. All right. We're going to do another one. This one's Cameron Carver. Any rare bird on eBird and submitted to records committees should be rejected if there is no specimen, audio, video, or photos. People are notoriously unreliable witnesses. So if there is no hard evidence, then a record should be rejected. Do you take it or do you leave it? Spicy records committee takes.
I think I'm going to leave that one.
Okay. All right.
I think I'm going to leave that one. I mean, I feel like you can usually get something, maybe almost always get something, right?
Yeah.
But there's that 5%, 10% chance that you're just not going to get that recording or that photo,
Yeah. I think to me, it might depend on the degree of rarity to some degree, but this is, I come very close to taking this in its entirety. For the reasons that Amy says, and in part to is sort of a little bit of backlash on my part to thing ivory-billed woodpecker reports. It's like, as Amy says, it when it comes to rare birds, documentation is possible, I would say, at this point, over 90% of the time. If you encounter something that is deemed rare, trips an eBird filter, or is thought extinct, I would say that you have a better than 90% of the chance most of the time of actually procuring an identifiable piece of evidence, be that a recording, video, or a photo. There's peers of mine and there are mentors of mine that just so value the written word on some of these descriptions and the artistry of that, that they would probably, would be ashamed of me were I to completely take that take. So I'm going to leave it, but with hesitation.
Yeah. I get where this is coming from because people are notoriously unreliable witnesses without doubt. I think that part of it comes from the fact that people don't write very good. This is a crotchety old me sitting on my front porch screaming at the kids on my lawn. People
I've
don't
seen you do that, by the way. You're really good at it.
It's a veranda here in the South. Yeah. People do not write very good rare bird reports anymore. Like they don't. I don't know whether it's a skill that has been sort of lost. And I know it's part of the ABA Young Birder of the Year modules. Like we kind of encourage kids to do that, to do field reports, sketches, all that stuff. But, speaking as someone that's been on a records committee, like I understand where this take is coming from because you frequently just do not have enough. This is where eBird comes into it too. People are used to tripping the filter and then giving you the absolute bare minimum of evidence. And a lot of times that's okay because there are photos attached, but people just do not write stuff that is compelling.
Continuing.
And, yeah. The curse of
continuing. If you go to some of... as we know, but just FYI for anybody who has never done so, if you go and you actually check out the forums, they'll teach you how to write a good description or at least, what factors to take into consideration, things to maybe mention, were you you're using binoculars, what were they, how was the light, how far away from this bird were you, you know, that sort of thing. And if you try, that's one way to learn how to write a good description.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, and certainly eBird does not necessarily encourage that, and nor it's arguably whether it even should. But for rarities committees, that is the sort of thing. And especially if rarity committees are increasingly pulling things from eBird to vote on, it becomes a problem, because then you're pulling that stuff from eBird and it just is not the sort of stuff that you need or want to be able to make a decision. And so you end up, you know, voting no a lot of times. But the last rare bird that I saw and had to write up in my state was a bird that I got photos of, fine photos, not great photos, but identifiable photos. And I actually took it upon myself to sit down and write what I thought was a really good rare bird just for the practice of it, because I, you know, wanted that out there and I kind of wanted to see if I could do it. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of work. Especially if you include a lot, everything that you, every part of the experience down to like where the bird was, what sounds the bird was making, how far away it was, how you saw it and all that stuff, how you recognized it. And it you understand why people might be inclined to like kind of poach content from the field guides that they use to identify that bird. And that's another part, because you can never tell whether someone is really doing that or not. But it's a lot. And I understand why people may not want to do that, but it's so helpful. But if people are not going to do it, then yeah, you need a photo or nothing, or you're not going to get it accepted.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe with AI, the written word will become more important with time. We'll see.
I'll ask ChatGPT, you know, how to defraud a rare bird community. I've also seen photos used to defraud people too. So that can happen as well. Boy, I'm tentatively going to take it, just because I agree with you, George. It's not hard to be able to get a photo, and people think it needs to be a great photo. It doesn't. It just needs to be a photo that doesn't, like, you know, dismiss everything that you've written, or, you know, a recording. Everyone has iPhones. If you can pull out your iPhone and get a little recording, a lot of times that can be helpful too. But I could see that changing if people got good at writing rare bird stuff again. You're mad at me.
I'm reconsidering.
Yeah, you're gonna. Oh, I thought you were gonna like throw something at me through the screen.
No, because I'm reconsidering. I'll stick with a very, very weak leave it.
Yeah, that's where I'm at.
It is interesting that these two to consider these two things like one after another, because if we are going to require audio video specimen for a rare bird, then maybe rare bird committees aren't necessary, because the stuff is self-evident, unless you need.
Well, it's not always though.
Yeah,
the photos aren't always great. Good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, increasingly they are, but I think I actually, we among friends, we have a competition to see who could get the worst identifiable photo of a rare bird. Like,
yeah.
Like, you know, you can tell what this is, but like, this is a terrible photo.
Yeah.
And we would see who could get the worst identifiable photo. I think that's a good exercise, actually. And I think
I love those.
Yeah, that's good fun. And I also think, like, a lot of people, as you say, Nate, are so concerned about those 4-star, 5-star photos. Mm-hmm. But my understanding is that the 1-star, 2-stars are actually the ones that are the most valuable to the eBird algorithm. So people fill them up.
I know that was the case before. Whether it's the case anymore, I'm not sure. But
yeah.
Still, there's not. I mean, it boosts your stats to put your terrible photos up on eBird, because you have more birds photoed on your little, your number goes up.
I think they're great for learning and teaching, because the look you get is not always going to be ideal. So like when I'm teaching people about birds, I often include a whole section of my worst bird photos to point out, okay, these are the field marks that you're looking for, and you can see it even in this terrible look.
Yeah, you know, leg color, or the undertail coverts, or you know, some weird little spot on the neck of the bird when that's all you can see through a dense brush or whatever. That's all you can see in your photo. Yeah, all that stuff is really valuable as a learning exercise for sure.
There's also people that are bad at technology, but they can write. And
that's
so
true.
And so I might, you know, just like I remember.
I know some great birders that never carry cameras.
Yeah. Yeah,
like 100% rock solid, you know.
Yeah, and I know some that have cameras and are really bad at using them. So
that hurts, George. That hurts.
But I think, like, just as I remember, like, kind of pre-digital, being on records committees and like getting these horribly written accounts. I shouldn't say horribly, but like sometimes people just can't write or don't know how to write, and they're very difficult to interpret what was actually seen.
Yeah.
And then those same observers get a digital camera, and all of a sudden you're like, oh my God, they're seeing all of this stuff.
Yeah, this is all legit. We have to go back and look at everything.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. We've had people like that in my state for sure. All right, we've got a couple more hot takes, and we'll why don't we just do them all? Mm-hmm. We're moving right through these. All right, here's a good one that has to do perhaps one that is with thought to the recent flamingo invasion from Kevin Perazzoni. There is never a legitimate reason to drive a naturally vagrant bird back to within its range. Now, this is something that happens from time to time when these birds end up in rehabilitation if they're injured or sick. Do we drive them all the way back to where they come from, or do we leave them where they are? Also, I do appreciate Kevin putting never in there, because that makes it much easier to make a to take it or leave it.
Yeah, that was well done on his part. Yeah. As a result, I feel like I have to leave it. Like, there's like,
exactly. Thank you. You know, thank you, Kevin.
But I would say, like, over 90% of the time, maybe over 90% of the time, it seems, you know, not even questionable, but just a bad idea to do so. But I bet you there are situations that where I personally might be in favor of it. Yeah, I don't know. I would think there'd be an exception, which is why the never part is helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Can't think of one though.
I think I'm gonna have to leave it too. Although I feel like I feel like I'm a little bit blasé in that I find the record really interesting, and I'm not so attached to the individual bird.
Cold-hearted.
I know. But that
I'm
said,
the same way. Just for what it's worth.
That said, I have respect for people that really do get attached in that emotional way and have that connection with this individual bird as a living, amazing, spectacular being, and that want to see us all do right by this bird. Mm-hmm. And I really can't knock that. Unless it's totally misguided.
Like a Rufus hummingbird?
Tell us that story.
Oh, well, I don't know anything about Rufus hummingbird, but the story that came to mind immediately was last summer, when a red-footed booby was discovered in St. Louis on the highway. It was injured, and it did eventually succumb to its injuries. But had it survived, what do you do with that bird? Like, do you release it on the Mississippi River and hope it goes south? I don't know, because
we had one in a cranberry bog last year.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, not when I say we, I mean my friend's brother, not me personally. So
I thought Jersey, you were going to say like generally Jersey. I didn't know it was going to be an actual person that you knew.
Yeah. Sent me some cell phone photos. But that bird, I guess, hopefully made its way to...
Yeah, that's close enough that you would hope that it would find its way to salt water eventually.
Yeah.
I guess, like, if you took that statement to extended it further and said, like, that you shouldn't rehab any rare bird...
We did get some takes. I didn't take that. I was saving that for a future episode. But we can jump into that, too. Because rehabilitation like, that's an interesting topic. Like, and there's a lot of wrinkles to it as well. Like, do you rehab invasive species like rock pigeons and European starlings?
No,
like, is that a waste of resources?
Yes.
I don't know. Yeah, well, there you go. Okay, so are you taking that one without hesitation?
Well, I think it's different with rare birds too, right? Because rare birds are already out of range. And then like the question comes up, are the resources you're going to sink into saving an individual bird that is already out of range and might just turn around and wander out of range immediately again? What if you put those into local, you know, local stuff that where, you know, it might be more productive? I think that's an argument that could be made.
I feel like sometimes all of the media and hoopla around some of these birds is a good thing, because it makes people who otherwise, you know, might not even be thinking about it start to think about it, and they see this bird, and that might be, people who might not be seeking this out, you know?
Certainly with the case of the Pennsylvania American flamingo that got bit by the snapping turtle, was, you know, the case. Do you take that into rehab? Do you try and save that bird? It eventually died for reasons not related to what the rehabbers did. But is that worth it? It's a single flamingo. American flamingo is, you know, not a globally threatened species. There are thousands upon thousands of them in the Caribbean, but this was a Pennsylvania bird. People got a lot of media attention. People got very attached to it. So I understand why they did it. What would they have done with it? I didn't know there was an active discussion, like when this bird is well again, what do you do with it? And that, you know, that kind of got made moot, but still that discussion was happening.
It is tough because if you leave it there to just wither and die, like people are like, you know, why'd who's you do that? The cold, heartless, you know,
you're just putting off the inevitable at that point.
Yeah. It's tough situation.
Yeah. So we're going to touch the third rail of birding politics with this last one and talk about owls.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my gosh.
Because there is not a group of birds that generates more heat in the birding world, I would imagine. So this one comes from Corey Husick, another Pennsylvania birder.
Mm-hmm.
In many cases, suppressing owl locations is just gatekeeping and bandwagon baloney, isn't actually providing a benefit to the birds themselves. Take it or leave it.
Man, that's a good one.
It's a good one. That's a good one.
Corey always comes up with some good material. Yeah. It's good.
For sure.
Jeez. Like I generally come out pretty pro owl sharing. You know, like I don't want to equivocate.
Yeah, I know, right? You don't want to make a strong statement there.
Yeah, but I think owls should be shared more often than they are. Mm-hmm. I think they're smarter, tougher birds than they are given credit for a lot of the time. But I also think people can be really badly behaved. Which is why this is such a good one. All right. I'm going to go bold. I'm going to take it. I'm going to defend the pro side of this.
Okay. Go for it.
Yeah. Well, I don't have much to say.
you already did, but yeah.
But I think there are shareable owls and there are times when people don't share just because, I think people also use, I have seen it where people use it as a bludgeon to sort of shame people for sharing an exciting sighting just because they might want some moral high ground and they don't actually know where the owl, understand where the owl is and that it's perfectly safe. You know? Owls are one of the best groups of birds in the world, right? They look smart. They're supposed to be wise. The swallowed owl's the cutest goddamn bird on earth, you know? Like we all love owls. Everybody loves owls. They're one of the best gateway birds in the world, which is part of why they should be shared. Just, you know, if we're trying to build more birders, trying to build more awareness of birds and their plight, I think sharing owls whenever possible is something that should be done. So I'm going to come out on the pro side. I'll leave it there.
Okay.
Oh my gosh. I've just seen too much bad behavior.
She's seen things, folks.
I've seen things.
She's seen things.
Oh man. I mean, he said most of the time, right? In many cases, right? Yep. Okay, I'll take this one.
Not
a really strong one. I mean, yeah, it depends on the species. Like, there's short-eared owl. Like, are you really going to hike all the way out into the marsh, you know, in the winter and bother that bird? Like, I don't know. I can't see how. I have never witnessed anybody harassing a short-eared owl. Are they safe to post? Yeah. But that's not going to be the one that people come to my neck of the woods to see much, right?
I have a real world experience this past winter in my home county with short-eared owl. A pair of short-eared owls turned up or were discovered. Maybe they've been coming for years. We don't know. But someone finally found them in a field near a very popular birding location in my county. Short-eared owl, regular bird on the coast in North Carolina, quite rare. Inland in the Piedmont. And so a lot of people were very excited because they could come out at dawn and at dusk. And these owls were almost always, I missed them twice. So I'm not bitter or anything, but you could come out at dawn or dusk. And most of the time, these owls were kind of flying around their field doing their short-eared owl thing. The first time I went out there to look for this owl, it's just a tad late because I had to drop my kid off at school. And I ran out there to try and see him. But there were a handful of other people around too. And some of the people were walking into the field. It was like, it wasn't in a gated or fenced off area. It was a field that people could walk out in there. There are like three of them. They were not organized or anything. And my initial response, my initial response was, oh, what are you doing? What are you doing out there? Right. And I was like, I'm doing this the right way. I'm going to stand here next to the field and wait for the owls to show up like a sucker. And they never show up in the rain. And the owls never showed up. But I started thinking like, yeah, okay, maybe they flush the owl and the owl goes off to another. Well, I guess if you see where it lands, you can continue to flush it. And that's really annoying. But they didn't. For what it's worth, they didn't pop up. No one saw the owls that day, though people saw them later that day.
At least they were incompetent.
Yeah, at least if you're going to be insensitive, at least be incompetent. Yeah, so that can apply to a lot of things. But I also witnessed a ton of people who came by and were extremely excited for the opportunity to see a pair of short-eared owls flying around this field. And the owls, for their part, did not seemed like they were like flushed to the point where they left, because they stayed through that the entire winter and people would still be able to go out and see them. So I guess the point that George was making, you know, these owls are, you got to give them a little bit of credit. They're not idiots. Like if they're going to be bothered, they're going to put up and go somewhere else and then you won't see them anymore. Cause a lot of times they're going to, you know, they're active at night. They could do it and you wouldn't even know. So I'm generally going to take this. I'm going to take this for the most part, just like all of you. Maybe it's not that hot of a take if we're all taking it. But I've seen the bad behavior, and it didn't seem like it affected the owls all that much, even so. So I guess you got to take it.
I feel like if we were discussing only solid owls and boreal owls.
Yeah, the ones that sit tight. Yeah. Yeah,
then we would all probably feel differently. But when I think it, very often it seems like it, like I've seen people, you know, screamed at, you know, mercilessly for saying, I had a short-eared owl here. That was so great. I loved it. And it's like, never reveal the location of an owl.
Oh, geez. Yeah.
You know, and you're like, all right, this person's just sharing an exciting sighting. And similar thing where somebody shared a barred owl that was nesting in the city, you know. And
yeah,
barred
we owl, got one of those too.
Yeah, yeah. And barred owl is like, I mean, they'll even attack people on occasions, you know.
Active
like
during the day.
And this thing was up 70 feet in a nesting. It's 70 feet up in a city park with people running dogs off leash below it, you know. Like, it chose that spot because it was pretty happy there. There was no harm in sharing it. But so there are certain species, I think, where it gets dicier. But I'm happy to see we all took that one. That was a juicy take.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. But I do think it, generally speaking, people are a little too secretive about that sort of stuff. And it does, as you know, just to focus on another part of Corey's take, it does seem like gatekeeping to me. Like, you are basically using that information as a way to, you know, only pass it on to people who deserve it. Yeah. That said, there are a lot of more birders now than there have been. And you know, maybe there's an opportunity for some conflict there. But I do think that the more situations like these exist, the more chances we have to kind of share how to enjoy these birds responsibly with people who are coming to birding, who are novices. And I think that's an opportunity that we should take.
Totally.
Yeah. All right. I want to thank George and Amy here for taking the bold stances that they did and having some great topics for discussion. Really good stuff here. We'll have to do this topic again down the road. Definitely a good one. Thank you to you both. Have a great spring, and we'll see you down the road.
Thanks so much, Nate. Thanks, very
guys.
Much enjoyed.
The American Birding Podcast is brought to you by the American Birding Association. Don't forget to join the ABA. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll be eligible for a lot of great benefits, including our fantastic magazines, all our online stuff like the magazine archive, the identification portal, and more. We've got more coming. I can't talk about it yet, but there's some good stuff. And of course, discounts to partners like OM Systems, Budio Books, Cornell Lab of Ornithology, and more. You can get more information at aba.org/join. A special shout out this week to Flan and Shannon Eller of Cody, Wyoming, Rich Krakowski and family of Hillsdale, New Jersey, and Mark Wolf of New York, New York, all of whom joined the ABA, noted this podcast as a reason for doing so. Thank you so much. Welcome to the ABA. Executive director of the ABA and executive producer of this podcast is Wayne Klockner, who is going to take the argument that herd birds count on your life list, by which he obviously means cowbirds and buffalo weavers. Technical production is by John Lowry, who thinks that birds that are the result of captive breeding efforts where the mated pair are introduced by humans should not count on life lists. It's a hot take. He believes that they're ship assisted.
Additional help comes from Maggie Fitzgibbon and Greg Neese, who hope that one of the common shell ducks in Newfoundland finds its way to St. Pierre and Miquelon to establish a breeding population there, because while one common shell duck is enough, two would make an oof. You can find us online at abia.org, on social media, most everywhere as American Birding Association, on Blue Sky, we're at ABA Birds. Questions, comments can come to podcast@aba.org. Thanks for listening. Bird like Tom. We'll see you next week.